Today, we talk about the European schools that have, among their alumni, the Brexit architect, Boris Johnson, and The Guardian's Alex Hearn on the robots lining up to take our jobs in journalism. Blimey. Peter Pomerantsev is a writer and academic. He was educated in Munich at one of 13 so-called European schools.
It was about being able to live with each other without smacking each other.
These institutions were the EU's great education experiment. Among their alumni was someone who'd go on to be the architect of Brexit.
They are special schools designed to essentially create a new type of human being, children who were in mind European.
One of those children was Boris Johnson. Like all pupils there, he would have been encouraged to learn 3, 4, even 5 languages. They were taught to cooperate, integrate, see things through the eyes of other European nations.
I had this incredible revelatory moment where we were doing Napoleon in French. And I grew up with Napoleon as a baddie. And here was Napoleon being described as a hero. In my head, kind of had to completely do this backflip to come and really see history from a French point of view.
Peter has a thesis that the EU schools are a microcosm of the EU as a whole.
They're a wonderful metaphor for the whole of the EU project.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what a European schools project tells us about the EU. I've never heard of them, so tell me, what are the European schools?
They are special schools designed by the creators of the EU in order to essentially create a new type of human being, a true European, whatever that might mean. It's an incredible experiment, which brings out all the good sides and the bad sides of the EU.
When was the first one built?
Is this like a test?
And I don't want you to Google.
I'm not Googling.
You've written about it, haven't you?
Yeah, but I don't like, you know, I was never very good at dates. You know, I don't want to give the wrong source. So, the foundation stone for the first one was laid on the 5th of July 1956 in Luxembourg. Essentially for the kids of international bureaucrats who had joined in the European coal and steel community, which was the forerunner to the EU, where they're trying to strike this balance. Without ceasing to look to their own lands with love and pride, they will become in-mind Europeans. But listen, they never define what European is. Now, that's the trick here. This is where I think we always have to understand how different this is to the American project, for example. They never define what they mean by European. All European seems to be is a way of a process, a way of understanding other people and not feeling alienated by them and not defining oneself angrily in opposition to them.
We're all thinking about the EU and Britain's role in the EU. You know, we've reached the kind of crescendo of Brexit. Why now did you choose to go back to your old school?
I suppose I was looking for a way to understand the European project and where it is right now. So that's why, you know, I do think the schools are a wonderful way of exploring that and seeing how it's worked out and where it's succeeded, where it's failed. Also, I'm 40 and there's something that happens when you're 40. You want to go back to your childhood.
I love the way you're like, there's this weird thing that happens. Could it be that very famous midlife crisis?
You think that's what it is?
Yes. So just tell us about little tiny Peter. Tell me about being sent to this school.
So, I was actually born in a country that doesn't exist anymore, called the USSR. And I came to Britain when I was 3 years old or so. My father worked for the BBC World Service, and then he moved to Munich in Germany to be a journalist. And I went with him, and I was around 15 and a bit. And my parents needed a school to send me to, and they wanted an international school so that I could go back to university in England one day, and they found the European school.
And how was it?
Up until that point, I had been at schools that were only for boys and with uniforms. And suddenly, at the age of 15, I was in a school where I think there were more girls than boys in my class. And it was just incredibly exciting. I didn't have to wear these awful English school uniforms with their ridiculous jackets.
Is this part of liberated. The kind of hipness of the European schools, that they don't have uniforms?
No. English schools are just weird that we have uniforms. We're the ones with the freakish kind of school systems.
Who knew?
But I was obviously, as a white middle-class boy, really into East Coast hip-hop. This was, of course, the summer of the first Wu-Tang Clan album, which was a big deal. So I was wearing really wide trousers. I mean, they were so wide that, the wind would catch them and kind of parasail through the streets. But the real interesting thing for me was that I'd grown up in London and I was definitely Russian. And I'd spent all my childhood trying to understand how do I negotiate my identity vis-a-vis these strange English people. And, you know, I'd always taken a position that I'm very different to you because I felt the English respected that. So the English don't like it when you're trying to blend in. It's not like the Americans. So I was like, I'm Russian, I'm different. I didn't really know what Russian meant. You know, it was the Cold War. I'd never been to Russia. I wouldn't say it was tortuous, but it was a complicated identity process that I went through as a child.
It's so interesting, isn't it? The point you make about America, because I always used to think this as well, that basically if you go to America, you're Indian American or you're African American or you're Russian American.
Yeah.
But you're all the same. Yeah. It's a different type of integration. Yeah. Well, in Britain, the idea, I guess, was to celebrate the difference. Hasn't always worked.
I think if when the English leave this planet and there'll be one object that sums them up, it'll be these strange park benches where you divide every seat. Yeah? The English are obsessed with difference, privacy, class, rigidity.
And so you're in Munich with your very, very, very baggy trousers,
your Russian background,
your British sort of background, girls, loads and loads of girls, suddenly... Does identity become something that's much easier for you?
Well, here's the paradox. I'm the most English person in the English section. So even though there are people there who are more ethnically English, they'd been expats for years. I just genuinely come from England. I knew the latest words. I knew the latest music. So there, for the first time in my life, I could be English. It was really, really funny because if you're in the English section, you essentially become, that's who you are. So the French are the French section. So all the other complicated bits of you kind of get cut off. And you're left with being from the English section.
So pupils are grouped in classes by language, but everyone was taught geography and history in a second language. So it was a really big mix. And in this kind of setting, people played up to their national stereotypes.
Yes, completely. In a very mild and playful way. And we all kind of pulled together attributes which summarised our identity, which for us was Monty Python was a really big thing. And eccentricity and humour. So we'd really play up, we're English, we're the crazy ones. The French were, the ones I remember, were very moody, very intellectual.
You said before that all the French girls wore Chanel. I assume you were joking. Or did they?
Not all of them. There was one called Tiffaine. Tiffaine was literally dressed like something from a Vogue catalogue and blew us all away. But they were classier. They had handbags. The French girls were already at 15. They just had their handbags. The Germans, it was different. They were in Germany, so it was a lot easier for them. But they were kind of the jocks in many ways. The Italians were actually by far and away the most guarded. They were like, we're Italian. They refused to eat the food. They were very, you know, they really made out their Italianness.
And did you integrate together? Who were your mates?
So my best mates were from my class. However...
And you say that as in, is everyone in your class English?
English-ish, yes. So my best friends were from my section. Maybe if I look back, a lot of people did have their best friends from their section. However, what happened was that it's a very paradoxical thing and hard to explain, but let me try. Even as you make your identity, your national identity, very performative and a bit of a game, it also becomes a lot lighter because you're very aware that you're performing it and they're performing theirs. And the stuff about learning things in a different language from a different point of view really works. I mean, I had this incredible revelatory moment where we were doing Napoleon in French. And I grew up with Napoleon as a baddie, Waterloo, Boney. And here was Napoleon being described as a hero who created a democratic model for Europe to follow in. And it was just this complete kind of head. My head kind of had to completely do this, like these backflips to come and really see history from a French point of view.
So you go back to the school.
I think the first thing that struck me, it's an audio experience, the European school. That's the main thing about it. It's all about sound. So it's a school break. We're in the aula, which is kind of the school hall. There seem to be a lot of you eating their packed lunches.
Well, I don't really know. I'm like both English and German. I don't really count myself as one of them. But I live in Germany, so I'm more German, I think. But yeah. Yeah.
And I suppose we're all listening for languages, because what was the wonderful thing about the European schools that you'd be surrounded by different languages and you'd understand all of them. Hungarian. We didn't have Hungarian in our day. Where's the staff room?
The teacher room.
Yeah.
Right there. Right over there on the left.
Yeah, but it hasn't changed. I do remember where it is. Come on.
So give me an example of issues you came across.
The European schools, at the end of the day, are an educational experiment. And it's a really hard one because all of the different countries have their own traditions of what a good education is and how you mark people. In the French class, you're marked down. So every mistake you make, you go down, down, down. And you're just meant to memorize whole blocks of facts. Suddenly, people who were very smart in one system were being told in another system that they were useless. Dr. Ensing, I'd never met before, is the current headmaster of the European School, a Dutch gentleman. While Mrs. Seeley was kind of... Mrs. Seeley, as a lot of English teachers are to a lot of teenagers, is kind of my favourite teacher. Both Dr. Ensing and Mr. Seeley said that this was still a problem. I mean, there had been great attempts to harmonise it. And I think Dr. Ensing sort of mentioned that, you know, every little change that happens in the curriculum has to be negotiated between 14 countries. It can take 15 years.
Already, like, we are discussing whether the language of the host country can be a language too.
It seems a no-brainer. Why has it been discussed for 15 years?
But it's 15 obvious. Years and the decision has not been taken yet, but the decision is about to be taken. So this is...
It was just a case of having to deal with so many layers of bureaucracy before a final decision could be taken. And that took years.
Wow, which really does mirror some of the frustrations that I suspect a lot of people who might have voted to leave the EU have with the European Union.
Without a doubt.
I love this idea that you essentially turned into a British gentleman in Munich. You really honed your Britishness. Who else who's famed for their extreme Britishness went through the system too?
If you look at one of the famous alumni of the European School, Boris Johnson. Well, he was in the Brussels schools between the ages of 8 and 11 or something? Those are important years. And that kind of buffoonery, caricature Englishness, which he presents, wouldn't have been out of place in the way we played up our Englishness.
So do you think it's possible that Boris Johnson, the architect of Brexit, didn't really get his very British personality from Eton? He actually got it in Brussels.
It's a working hypothesis. I think there's something to that.
In his book, The Dream of Rome, Boris Johnson has described his years at the EU school in Brussels with derision. So I asked the man who decided to send him there, his dad, Stanley, why he chose it.
When you go to Brussels, as I did in 1973, as, by the way, one of the very first Brits to be appointed to the European Commission, one of the things you realise is that you still have to have your children educated. You did have to think about education. Now, you know, of course, the English are quite used to sending their children off to, you know, to boarding school. But I was, you know, I not necessarily was going to go for that down that route, and it did seem to me that the European school offered, you know, a very good possibility. And indeed, Boris and Rachel both went there. They went to, I thought, rather a nice school in a rather leafy suburb, and there the kids were. And they were, I thought, learning to be good little Europeans.
Do you have any memories of the kids enjoying the school?
I'm pretty sure they did enjoy it. I cannot imagine why they would not have enjoyed it. It did seem to me that this school offered a huge amount, not just running around in the, you know, you learn German, you learn French, well, nowadays you can probably learn Polish too.
Do you think any of his views, which, let's admit it, have become quite important for us all, his views on Europe, were born in your time in Brussels?
No, if at all, it came from his years in Brussels, because he came back to Brussels. And I think then, if you like, the germ of Euroscepticism was sown.
Boris felt that the school encouraged cliques and ghettos, that integration was in fact a myth, and that there existed a firm principle of apartheid.
It's interesting. So there have been sociological, I think, studies of the canteens. And there might be some truth in that. There might be some truth that people do somehow instinctively move to their different language sections. I know a lot of people who've been to the schools, and that's certainly not the main takeaway they have. I think the biggest critique of the schools is the relationship between the schools and the outside world. So it's very interesting when...
This isolation you're talking about.
Yeah, isolation. So the schools were, even when I was there, not very good at mixing with the local communities. It's something they talked about a lot but could never find a way to do. When we went back now, that failing was still very much there. People who live around the European schools don't like the school. They feel it's not for them. They can't send their kids there.
So the negative, the big potential negative part of the metaphor for the European schools to the EU project is basically that you almost created an elite, an isolated elite.
Yes.
And that other people felt separate from that elite and frustrated by that elite and perhaps a little bitter about it.
Or could project all their bitterness onto it. So I'd say the people at the European schools were much less elitist than people who went to Boris Johnson's other schools. But there was clearly this barrier. So no, I do think without a doubt that's the big failure.
So you returned to England when you were 16. What was it like?
It was quite weird. I'd only been away like 2 and a bit years. And like, I guess teenage culture changes really fast. It took me a long time to reintegrate.
Were your trousers too baggy?
Baggy trousers, big no-no. Big no-no. And I, in the end, I managed to catch up again. While a very famous thing among everyone who went to the European schools is that they go back and they can't fit in anymore. I had a couple of best friends at the European school, but my bestest friend was Liam Green. Liam put it very well. He said,
"I don't know if you meant it seriously, that the European school helped one not to integrate anywhere."
Yeah, that might sum it up. I suppose if integrate means docking on and becoming part of something else, then yeah, you have every ability to play the part to be somewhere else, but you don't really, you never really have the docking on element. The fact that a cultural identity doesn't define who you are. Yeah, it can be lonely, but it can also be freedom.
Studies show that 18% of alumni complain of isolation, 6.2% of rootlessness, and 5.8% of not fitting in their home country anymore. Which is kind of the story that you and Liam both seem to have told.
Yeah, without a doubt, everybody that I spoke to, they all went through that experience. They all come back to their home countries and find that they're not like them anymore.
But do the schools tell us about why the EU project may succeed or may not?
There's the one thing that struck me on this visit to the EU school. I've always been very fond of its model of what you call integration. I wouldn't call it that, sort of learning how to not hate other people. But paradoxically, it does it along this kind of very strange line, the European process of smoothing polarization between nations. We now have a generation of people who are already not national already. They'd have a Latvian mom or a Polish dad. You know, they're already mixed. They're not even facing that challenge. And in that sense, the goals that the European Union set itself, it succeeded. It's almost like a new challenge that we're now facing. Common defense, common security, you know, all this mess with the euro. And in a similar way, the school, I feel now, might face challenges that it didn't then. What do you do now if you're a Latvian-Italian kid? Why do you want to go to the German section or the French section or the Latvian section? You're already European. What do you do next? You know, what's the next challenge to get over?
Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the robots that can knock off a fairly sophisticated news story, write science fiction, and even come up with a daily news podcast. Welcome back. Now The Guardian's UK technology editor, Alex Hearn, talks about AI so advanced that the company that makes it doesn't dare bring it to market.
This email landed in my inbox from OpenAI, an Elon Musk-backed AI research nonprofit, which exists to sort of responsibly push the boundaries of what is possible with artificial intelligences. And they sent me this long document detailing this new AI system they'd created, GPT-2. It's a text generator, essentially. You give it a short prompt of text, and it generates more text in response to that. And I just hit these examples, and they were breathtaking. They were so much better than anything I'd seen before, so much better than what I thought AI was capable of doing. Give it the headline of a news story, and it generates a very, very plausible, completely artificial news story in response. Give it something more literary, and it generates a short story. Give it a question, and it tries to answer it using its knowledge of the world. Replied with this one word, all caps, wow, and asked them to let me use it. So the prompt we can give it is, let's do today's episode of The Guardian's flagship podcast. Today in focus, what does it take us to? The rise and rise of the American Taliban. The American Taliban is a new coalition of fighters in the fight against the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, ISIL. The group has a loose and rapidly expanding network of supporters and sympathizers in the United States, although it has not taken responsibility inside the country. That would be a good Today in Focus episode. As I was playing around with it, feeding it different chunks of text, I was, you know, repeatedly struck by how good it was at doing it. I feed it the first line of 1984, and it gives me a short chunk of science fiction prose set in 2045 in China. It has, I mean, it doesn't, you know, it's a series of equations, but it feels like it has imagination and creativity as well. They're not going to release GPT-2 to the public, because they're worried that it's so good that there are real malicious uses that it could be put to. It would be very good at writing spam. It would be very good at doing fake reviews or putting together fake news stories that you can't tell aren't real. You know, that's a powerful ability. But it's also a tool that can be used in some really fascinating ways. One of my favorite things to do with this AI has been using it to generate fiction, creative writing, imaginative text.
Roses are red, violets are blue, the flowers are white.
As a joke, I put in the prompt, roses are red, violets are blue, because I was writing the story on Valentine's Day, and it spat out a poem that was really good.
And in the end of the days of a year, there is the last of those who dwell below, and in the sun's last rays, they will all die. And the last of the green is blue, and the last of the blue is green.
It's a good, chilling poem that feels like it has theme and subtext. OpenAI doesn't think this will stay locked up for that long. Within reason, a similarly resourced competitor with a similar fleet of fantastic AI researchers will be able to replicate this research in a few months. If it does happen that quickly, if we do have just 3 or 4 months maybe before something like this does get released to the wider public, that means that it's important that we have conversations now about things like whether we need to start going down the process of regulating this use, regulating the creation of these, and also just means that everyone out there needs to accept that this is going to happen soon and start thinking that it's possible, start accepting that this is the world now.
Well, here at Today in Focus, we are all quite nervous about the robot journalist, but we quite like the robot poet. So here he is to play us out.
Roses are red, violets are blue, the flowers are white and the leaves are purple, and everything has its time of birth. The sky and the stars, each in its turn, have their seasons, and the seasons return by time again. And in the end of the days of a year, there is the last of those who dwell below, and in the sun's last rays they will all die. And the last of the green is blue, and the last of the blue is green. The world is a place where everything returns by its own time. For as it has said, and as the world has said, it returns and returns and returns again, and yet it never dies.
That's all we've got time for today. My thanks to Peter Pomerantsev and Alex Hearn. Today's episode was produced by Lucy Greenwell and Brenna Daldorf. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executives are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. I'm going to be away this week, but India Rakesan will be with you tomorrow.